Good morning, everybody, and welcome to the House State Government Finance Committee. Today is February 10th. It's a Thursday, and pursuant to House Rule 10.01, this meeting is being held virtually. And before I start, I take the roll. I just want to remind members that if you can, please have your video on when you're speaking, so we can see who you are and the public can see who you are. And also when you are not speaking, if you can have your microphones muted so that we don't get background noise from everybody else or feedback. It helps in the recording for posterity that this is going to be. Legislative Assistant Brinks, can you take the roll?
Certainly. Thank you, Chair Nelson. Chair Nelson.
I'm here.
Chair Nelson is present. Vice Chair Carlson?
Carlson present.
Vice Chair Carlson is present. Representative Nash?
Nash present.
Representative Nash is present. Representative Bonner?
Bonner present.
Representative Bonner is present. Representative Drazkowski?
Present.
Representative Drazkowski is present. Representative Elkins.
Elkins present.
Representative Elkins is present. Representative Greenman.
Present.
Representative Greenman is present. Representative Cleavorne.
Cleavorne present.
Representative Cleavorne is present. Representative Tosnick.
We didn't hear you, Representative Tosnick.
Tosnick present.
Thank you.
Representative Tosnick is present. Representative Mason.
Mason present.
Representative Mason is present. Representative New Brindley.
Present.
Representative New Brindley is present. Representative Pawlowski.
Pawlowski present.
Representative Pawlowski is present. Representative Quam.
Present.
Representative Quam is present. Chair Nelson, with that, we have a quorum.
We have a quorum, so with that, the next order of the business is the approval of the minutes. And Representative Cleavorne, have you get a chance to look at the minutes?
I have, Chair Nelson, and I move that the minutes be adopted.
Motion's been made to approve the minutes from the February 8th meeting. All in favor, please unmute and say aye.
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 Opposed? The minutes have been approved. Members, we have a couple of bills up here for us today, and I'll start by welcoming Representative Noor to the committee, and I'll move that House File 2399 be referred to the Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law Committee. Welcome to the committee, Representative Noor.
Thank you so much, Mr. Chair and members. Mr. Chair, I do have an A1 amendment.
Representative Noor has an A1 amendment. Let me pull that up here for my screen here. I'll move the A1 amendment. Members, if you want to unmute, all in favor of the amendment, please say aye.
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 Opposed? The ayes have it. If you want to describe what the amendment does to the bill, Representative Noor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The amendment ensures that there's no vacuum in terms of how the leadership for the LBO from the House and the Senate. So it ensures that the party that controls the House has got the opportunity to become the chair, whether it's the House or the Senate, and not both parties can be, the chair and the vice chair. So this ensures a smooth transition. It removes ambiguity in terms of how to run this newly created office and to be able to continue the work.
Thank you, Representative Noor. Is the amendment a delete all, or is that explain the bill itself also?
It's just that small portion of the explanation that I made. So the bill by itself, Mr. Chair, members, the LBO, or Legislative Budget Office, is charged with evaluating proposed legislation and also making sure that if there are any potential impact on the state budget. Mr. Chair and members, the LBO staff receives the fiscal notes, and they make sure that the accuracy, visibleness, and compliance with fiscal notes policies and standards prior to submitting to the legislature. Mr. Chair and members, this bill ensures that the LBO staff have access to data and agencies' subject matter experts to prepare review fiscal notes. It also authorizes the LBO to prepare fiscal notes if an agency does not comply with the requirement that they shall produce a fiscal note. Mr. Chair and members, this bill also clarifies classification of unofficial fiscal notes. It's considered to be a public data unless it's requested by the author to be made public. It ensures the integrity of the system by ensuring that the fiscal notes are held as private data when there's no bill attached to it, when the request of the author or the person who has requested it gets that opportunity. And finally, the small change that we made is just to clarify the leadership for the LBO, the Legislative Budget Office. Mr. Chair, I do have testifiers. I do have the interim executive director and also the executive director for LCC with us and MMB who want to testify on this bill.
And you said I have a list of testifiers. The first person on my list is Christian Larson. If you want to identify yourself for the record and then proceed with your testimony.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Christian Larson. I'm the Interim Director of the Legislative Budget Office. I'm here to speak of support of the original bill, House Bill 2399. The LBO has no position on the A1 amendment, but I can walk through the portions of the bill that we do have a position on and kind of talk about what the impact is for the Legislative Budget Office. So as Representative Nord had stated, we're kind of a new office. We've been around for 2 years now. We have two sessions under our belt. We're now working into our third. And in that time, we're able to see what works really well in the fiscal note process and what kind of areas of tension there are existing within the current process. And so this bill addresses some of those tension points. Section one, and what is now section three, kind of answers the question, what happens if the LBO does not approve a fiscal note? Currently, what happens if, and these are rare occasions when an agency and the LBO doesn't come to a conclusion on what should be carried for a fiscal estimate, but in those rare instances, there's no real resolution in the current process. What happens right now is fiscal note often sits in a preliminary status and never gets released to the legislature or to the public. Section 1 and Section 3 would give the authority, would clearly state the authority of the LBO to then work with agencies and agency staff to receive the necessary data for us to complete the fiscal estimate, and then release that information to the legislature. What was Section 3 and is now Section 4. Again, as Representative Nord stated, this really clarifies how the LBO is supposed to handle the unofficial fiscal note process, specifically regarding classified unofficial fiscal notes. It gives more clarification to what we already are doing in practice. So we are interpreting the law to do what the additional language does, kind of clearly states, which it helps clarify when an unofficial classified fiscal note becomes public, and also who has access to the classified information of the proposed legislation and the resulting fiscal note. And finally, what is now Section 5, this helps address the tension point of how we measure what the LBO is doing and how successfully are we, and now we're getting better over time. And so, currently, the Legislative Budget Office is quite good at measuring timeliness. And if we have to think about the LBO and what the fiscal process does, we're saying, are we producing things in a timely manner, and are we producing things that are accurate? We're very good at measuring timeliness. We can measure how often fiscals are done by a due date, how many days it takes to complete a fiscal note, and things of that nature. We don't have as good of information about the accuracy of information that's coming out. So what this Section 5 does really states that the LBO has the authority to work with agencies to receive information that says we can look back on bills that passed and then had a fiscal note attached to say how accurate was that estimate. So this will allow us to kind of grow in that area and saying, can we measure both the timeliness and accuracy of the Legislative Budget Office? And with that, I can stand for questions.
Thank you, Mr. Larson. And before we go to questions of Mr. Larson, that was pointed out to me, we didn't actually vote on the amendment to put the amendment on. And I understand Representative Nash has a question on the amendment. So Representative Nash, before we vote, proceed with your question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And we're running low on internets out here in Waconia this morning, so I will not be on video. But to the author of the amendment, Representative Neuer, question for you. I understand that this bill in the Senate is being carried by Senator Kiffmeyer. I wanted to ask if this amendment is also being amended into her version of the bill over in the Senate.
Representative Neuer.
Mr. Chair, I did discuss this amendment with the chair, so this is the first time it's being introduced here, and we're hoping that it's going to be adopted in the Senate too.
And Mr. Chair. Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, Representative Neuer, I'm sure discussing it was, and that's good, but what did Senator Kiffmeyer say as you talked about this amendment?
Representative Neuer.
Mr. Chair, Representative Nash, I think we don't want to go into what has transpired in the office since the last election process, but this is a fix to an issue that we have encountered. So we discussed and shared, and I think we all agree we needed a guidance in that process to be included through legislative process. And so this amendment will be attached to the Senate bill.
Representative Nash.
Well, Mr. Chair, I guess Representative Neuer, I was led to believe by the first part of your answer that you had briefly discussed this with Senator Kiffmeyer, but that it wasn't going to be engrossed into the Senate bill, and now you just said that it is. So I'm a little confused, and I was also confused by your statement about the last election process. Well, this isn't an election-oriented effort. This is a fantastic effort led by our former colleague, Representative Vogel, to give us objectivity into how fiscal notes are created. So I'm just a little confused as to how elections have a bearing in this. If you could clear that up for me.
Chair Neuer.
Mr. Chair, Representative Nash, I'm referencing the process of how we elect the chair and the vice chair in the Legislative Budget Office, myself and also I see also Representative Elkins, who serves on the Legislative Budget Office. We have hit a little bit of a wall because this is supposed to be nonpartisan. So we have members both equally from the House and the Senate to ensure that smooth transition. This is the mitigation that we need to put in place to ensure the functioning and also removing any ambiguity in the process of how we handle business through the Legislative Budget Office.
Representative Nash.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
With that, any other questions of the amendment? If not, all in favor of the amendment, you want to unmute and please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposition? Say no.
No.
The ayes have it. The amendment is put on. The next testifier we have is Michelle Robert Weber. Please, again, unmute yourself and state your name for the record. Ms. Weber.
Mr. Chair and members, I'm Michelle Weber with the Legislative Coordinating Commission. And prior to serving in that role, I was the director of the Legislative Budget Office for 2 years. So I am just primarily here to respond to any questions in case Interim Director Larson did not have access to that information that occurred when I was the budget director at that time.
Thank you, Ms. Weber. With that, I'll go to the next testifier, Britta Rattan from the Minnesota Management and Budget Office. Welcome to the committee, and please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Britta Rattan. I'm Deputy Commissioner at MMB. MMB does have some concerns with the changes that are included in this bill. First, MMB budget staff should not be prohibited from being involved in the preparation of unofficial fiscal notes. And that is one provision of this bill is to prevent MMB's involvement in those notes. MMB does have a continuing responsibility to manage the state's finances, including ensuring that the global state government budget, the budget overall, is balanced, and to partner with and advise state agencies as they assess the fiscal implications of legislative proposals. So I want to be clear that the goal of our involvement is to help ensure that the executive branch is providing high quality, accurate and consistent information early in the process to the legislature. We want to help prevent inaccurate or inconsistent fiscal estimates from being provided to the legislature and limit the need for MMB to raise concerns after the fact or after a fiscal note has been approved through the process. To be clear, the involvement of MMB budget staff in the preparation of these notes does not compromise the confidential nature of the notes. It is not shared beyond the budget staff that are working in an ongoing way in an advisory and consultative role with agencies. Second, we generally have concerns about the expansion of the LBO authority related to reviewing the accuracy of previously enacted notes. And I want to be very clear, we agree with the need for the accuracy. And the work here is very valuable. The concern is more that there has been very limited outreach from the LBO to agencies to define the scope of this work and the roles of the LBO versus agency staff in completing this analysis. It's highly likely that the LBO would need to rely on agency staff to produce much of the analysis, considering that agencies are the ones that are, in fact, producing the notes, particularly on complex forecast programs. And especially in our current environment, agencies do not have additional staff capacity to simply absorb this work. In the off season, when we're not preparing fiscal notes during legislative session, agencies, those same staff that work on fiscal notes, are busy establishing their budgets as enacted by the legislature, typically working on the fiscal close process at the end of the fiscal year, building out their spending plans based on the enacted budgets to MMB as required by law, and then preparing their biennial budgets for submission to the legislature the next session. And at the same time, they would be asked to be taking on the additional work in this bill. So our concern is just about agency capacity in order to absorb this work. And with that, Representative Nelson, I can stand for questions. Oh, I think you're muted, Mr. Chair.
Sorry about that. I didn't want to hear everybody have me hear me sneeze. And any other testifiers before we go to questions on this bill? If not, Representative Elkins, I see you have your hand up.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I have my hand up before we voted on the A1 amendment. I just wanted to make a comment that the A1 amendment, all it does is codify the long-term custom and practice for LCC committees in terms of the rotation of the chair. And you know, for reasons I need not get into here, that's getting in the way of the functioning of that particular LBO oversight committee right now. Former Representative Bob Vogel is a good friend of mine who coached me, encouraged me to get involved in the LBO process, which I did. And so the current state of affairs on that commission is extremely frustrating to me. So the A1 amendment that we've incorporated onto the bill is a very important part of the bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Elkins. Any other questions of the bill as amended? If not, Mr. Brinks, can you please take the roll? I'll renew my motion that House File 2399, as amended, be referred to the Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law Committee. Mr. Brinks.
Chair Nelson.
Aye.
Vice Chair Carlson.
Carlson, aye.
Representative Nash. Representative Bonner.
Aye.
Representative Drazkowski.
No.
Representative Elkins.
Elkins, aye.
Representative Greenman.
Aye.
Representative Cleborne.
Aye.
Representative Kosnick.
No.
Representative Mason.
Aye.
Representative New Brindley.
No.
Representative Pawlowski.
Pawlowski, aye.
Representative Quam?
No.
Representative Nash?
Nash votes no.
With a vote of 8 ayes and 4 nays, the motion prevailed.
The motion prevails. The bill is on its way. Thank you, Representative Neuer. The next bill we have on our agenda is House File 2017, Representative Ryer. I will move House File 2017 to be referred to the Workforce and Business Development Finance and Policy Committee. Representative Ryer, welcome to our committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I also have an A1 amendment.
And the A1 amendment, if you want to describe the amendment, I'll move the A1 amendment. If you want to describe what the amendment does to the bill.
I would like to thank you. It is a very technical amendment. It takes some language and, as recommended by Deed, aligns it more with the language that they currently use and aligns it with their current job responsibilities. If you want more specifics on that, it's pretty micro.
No, I'm looking at it here on my computer. And I guess if any member questions about the amendment. I'm seeing none, no hands popping up. Representative Elkins, did you have your hand up from the last time?
No, sorry, Mr. Chair.
That's what I thought. I noticed it didn't go down. If not, everybody want to unmute, and all in favor of the A1 amendment to put the bill in the order that the author wants, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The ayes have it. The bill's amended. Representative Ryer, do you want to explain your bill then, what it does?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. I'm here today to talk about House File 2017, a bill that adopts the recommendations from the Advisory Task Force on State Employment and Retention of Employees with Disabilities. This bill means a lot to me. I ran for office, as I'm sure we all did, to make a difference and to make the world a better and fairer place. House File 2017 does this by implementing the straightforward but very important recommendations that you'll hear about in a moment. The essence of the bill is that the state of Minnesota needs to do better to have a workplace where people with disabilities succeed. Right now, we fall short. However, I'm convinced that as a state government, we have the will to make the changes that are required. These changes are embodied in the recommendations that, and I quote the task force report, will demonstrate the state of Minnesota's commitment to the hiring, retention, and advancement of people with disabilities by modernizing outdated and potentially discriminatory language, creating more clarity and consistency, and adding capacity for essential equity work. I'd like to thank the task force participants for your hard work from 2019 to 2021, including through the height of the pandemic. And my thanks too to Deed and MMB for working through details of this bill. Next, Trevor Turner from the Minnesota Council on Disability will explain the bill in more detail. Thank you. I look forward to your questions and ask for your support to pass this bill out of the State Government and Elections Committee and on to its next stop at the Workforce and Business Development Finance and Policy Committee.
Thank you, Representative Ryer. We have testifiers for the bill. And do you have a, I've got Trevor Turner first.
Yes,
Mr.
Please.
Turner, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, members of the committee. My name is Trevor Turner, and I am the Public Policy Director for the Minnesota Council on Disability. I'm also a deafblind Minnesotan. The Minnesota Council on Disability is leading efforts to increase disability representation in the Minnesota state government workforce. We believe that more disability representation in our state enterprise, especially those in leadership positions, will lead to better decisions being made around state disability policies. House File 2017 would codify the recommendations made by the Advisory Task Force on the Employment and Retention of Employees with Disabilities. This bill would demonstrate the state of Minnesota's commitment to hiring, retention, and advancement of people with disabilities by modernizing outdated and potentially discriminatory language, creating more clarity and consistency on disability employment policy, training and educating hiring managers, providing a support structure for employees with disabilities, and adding capacity for essential equity work. Minnesotans often face insurmountable barriers, and the state of Minnesota is no exception. Unfortunately, Minnesota does not have adequate disability representation in its workforce. Far too often, policies that significantly impact Minnesotans with disabilities are decided by a small group of non-disabled policymakers. Minnesotans with disabilities need not only our voices to be heard, but a seat at the state governing table. This is a nothing about us without us bill, which would require more consultation with people with disabilities. Increasing disability employment and retention among our state government workforce creates a pipeline of future leaders and policymakers with disabilities in our state enterprise system. When Minnesotans with disabilities make decisions in our agency, the disability community in our state will be better represented in and better served by our state government. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Turner. The next person I have on my list is Eric Nooker. And if you want to identify yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and committee members. I'm Eric Nooker. Thank you for this opportunity to testify. I work as a grant administrator for the Minnesota Department of Agriculture, and I'm testifying on my own behalf, not my employer's, and I'm here on my own time. I have an undergraduate degree in horticulture and a master's degree in soil science. I was born deaf and used cochlear implants and American Sign Language to communicate. Struggles with communication barriers have made me stronger and a better self-advocate. I've been an advocate for employing and retention of employees with disabilities since I became a state employee in 2014, just before Governor Dayton signed Executive Order 1414. I'm fortunate to work in an environment where my employer ensures I receive the accommodations I need, where we are aware of resources available to me and my agency, such as the Accommodations Fund. My past involvement with the Connect 700 program relaunch has helped me to work with the ADA coordinator and hiring manager to set up what I need to do my job. I'm excited when colleagues with disabilities become state employees, and yet they're not always as fortunate as me. They may not be aware of the state resources available to them and their agencies. Sometimes their hiring managers and agencies don't know much more than they do. Strong, knowledgeable ADA coordinators are important for this reason. A good coordinator can mean the difference between an employee successfully completing probation to become permanent versus losing their job because the employee did not have timely and reasonable accommodations during the 700-hour trial period. I took time off today to testify because I want to see people with disabilities like me who have so much to contribute to have a level playing field. I want others to have the same positive experiences I have had. I urge you to support the changes in House File 2017 so we can do a better job of retaining and recruiting a diverse workforce. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Nooker. The next person I have on my list is Bobby Silverstein. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you. My name is Bobby Silverstein. I am currently the policy and legislative counsel to what's called the State Exchange on Employment and Disability, or the SEED Project. I am the former staff director and chief counsel to the U.S. Senate Subcommittee on Disability Policy. And I had the incredible honor and privilege of being a staffer in the Senate when we worked on 20 consensus bipartisan bills enacted into law, including the landmark Americans with Disabilities Act. SEED is a very unique state-federal collaboration. Our partners include, among others, the National Governors Association and the National Conference of State Legislatures, the Council of State Governments. What SEED does is provide policy assistance to state policymakers. We do not endorse bills. we are not endorsing HF 2017. We provide bipartisan, nonpartisan policy assistance. So my written testimony includes examples of policies that reflect the same themes and policies that are embedded in this bill that are reflected in the task force report. Those themes include having the state as a model employer of people with disabilities, make sure that disability is included in the diversity, equity, inclusion initiatives, just like other states are doing. The importance of digital accessibility is reflected across the country. We depend on internet and intranet for our data and information. This makes sure that the information is accessible to and usable by people with disabilities. There's an adage that gets what gets measured and reported and has consequences gets done. This bill is consistent with that adage in terms of the affirmative action plans that existed but have been updated, the goals, the workforce analysis, the and the progress report, including the audits.
Put any more creamer in it.
In terms of the legislation, also includes training, which is critical to make sure that the policy is in fact implemented. The alternative non-competitive hiring process, the 700-hour on-the-job demonstration experience, has been updated consistent with updates in other states. And the reasonable accommodation fund and the process to make sure that managers and supervisors are aware of it and use it. In sum, this legislation is consistent with policies adopted in other states, and I hope that you will take advantage of the written testimony to help you analyze the bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Silverstein, and members on the agenda that's posted on the schedules from the House website. The written testimony is there and in the record. So thank you, Mr. Silverstein. The next person on the list I have is Thomas DeVita. Kenneth Rogers is the next person, and then Thomas DeVita. Mr. Rogers, please identify yourself for the tape and proceed with your testimony. And I assume you're not the country singer.
Good morning, Chair and committee members. My name is Ken Rogers. I currently work at the Minnesota Department of Transportation. I am the Disability Programs Coordinator. And what that basically means is I'm one of the ADA coordinators that work specifically on Title I accommodations, employment-related accommodations for employees statewide. I do this job full-time every day, 5 days a week or more, and that's my entire job, is to ensure that employees who identify as individuals with disabilities who are having an issue performing an essential function of their job because of their disability or medical condition have an opportunity to develop reasonable accommodations that will allow them to be able to be successful in their job duties. I am here today speaking on my own behalf. I am not representing the Department of Transportation. I'm not speaking on behalf of the Department of Transportation. I am speaking as my own voice, as a citizen and resident of Minnesota. And I happen to be a person who lives with a disability. I am blind. I have no sight. I was not born blind. I acquired my disease in midlife and lost my sight within a year after diagnosis of a rare retinal eye condition. I have a perspective that's pretty unique in our environment, in that half of my life was lived as a person with full sight and fully able. And half of my life, the latter half of my life, has been lived for the last 25 plus years as a person without sight. Having to transverse those two environments gives me the value of a perspective that most people don't have. I am a full-time person that works on accommodation issues within the Department of Transportation as my job. I'm lucky, and I consider myself very grateful, and the department grateful, for having this role in the first place. As has been mentioned previously, having an ADA coordinator, someone to work on this aspect of the job, is critical to the success of raising the level of individuals with disabilities in the state workforce. We can do all the actions we want to get people in the door, but if we don't create a successful environment, a safe environment, an environment that has supports for an individual with a disability that needs that support to figure out how to navigate successfully in their environment, we're not going to keep that individual, or we're going to end up losing that individual. That costs the state money. I'm very conscious about the use and spending of taxpayer dollars, and that's not an appropriate way for us to be doing our work. Again, I mentioned that I'm a full-time person doing this work. There are only two agencies, I believe, that I'm aware of that have a full-time ADA person like me, the Department of Transportation and the Department of Human Services. The other agencies are required under the ADA to have a person designated to do this responsibility, but it often is a designation added to someone's role in Human Services Department, and it's one more added role to somebody's already long list of obligations that they're responsible for. It's not a full-time gig for any other individual, and thus makes it very difficult for any traction to be developed and learned of best practices and how to successfully support individuals with disabilities in the workspace. This bill it was a product of recommendations created by a legislatively designed task force. While I was not a member of the task force officially, the membership was limited to mostly executive directors or high-level individuals representing state organizations with disabilities within the state government structure to serve as content experts to devise these recommendations. I attended probably greater than 90% of the meetings and participated actively in the development of these recommendations. I'm also an individual, because of my role within state government, was at the table when this program was being designed and developed prior to being submitted to Governor Dayton for inclusion in Executive Order 1414. I understand I was a part of the discussions that determined the spirit of this law, the spirit of this project, the spirit of this activity, and worked within the policy design to figure out how we could implement this program at a policy level that would have some success built into its parameters. I serve for the purposes of my testimony today to help answer questions that people might have related to what's in this bill and these recommendations. I can provide some background information that might be helpful if someone has some of those types of questions. Again, I'm here on my own personal time. I believe this is the direction that we as a state need to move in order to fully realize and move the dial for the improvement and the increasing the level of individuals with disabilities within our state workforce. There's a greater than 70% unemployment rate for individuals with disabilities. I was one of them. when I first lost my sight and tried to find a job, I couldn't get past the interview process. I had no tool to allow me to have any type of an opportunity other than the normal competitive interview process that we all are familiar with. Having a program designed like Connect 700 to be able to provide a qualified individual who meets the minimal qualifications of the job and has the experience needed to succeed in this type of a job has now a backdoor to enter and level the playing field and give them an opportunity to prove that they are able to, and demonstrate that they are able to provide the job skills needed to be successful in this role. These recommendations tighten up the process so that it is similar across the all agencies, and that agencies don't venture off on their own and design what works for them with their own changes. This will help streamline this process greatly and is very much needed. With that, I will stop and I stand for questions.
Thank you, Mr. Rogers, and thank you for your service to the state. The last person I have on the list, and I have two listed here, is if needed. I'm assuming that's for questions, Mr. Finley and Mr. Parker. Welcome to the committee, Mr. DeVita. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Representative Nelson and committee members. My name is Thomas DeVita, and I am a DVS program director at the Department of Public Safety Driver and Vehicle Services. I will add that I did submit some written testimony this morning in addition to the oral testimony that I'm giving now. Ms. Rudolph can transmit that when she finds time available, that's greatly appreciated.
Mr. DeVita, I believe, let me look here. I don't know if I see it here, but we'll get it attached to our agenda that we have posted online.
No problem. Thank you, Mr. I'll proceed, though. I'd like to thank the legislature for taking on board initiatives that address bias and discrimination occurring within the civil service employment ranks. Legislation and the authors of HF 2017 bolster opportunities for individuals with disabilities for the state of Minnesota is extremely important. As a DVS program director, my job role has significant ability to ensure that individuals with disabilities receive equitable recruitment, hiring, training, and retention, but I have the unique perspective of being a Connect 700 participant myself. I was hired through the Connect 700 program in 2017, one of the few participants to be placed into the managerial class with oversight of a significant number of work units at Driver and Vehicle Services and a significant number of staff, including multiple other Connect 700 participants. However, addressing bias and discrimination has not been easy because of deep and institutional effects crossing that cross agency and divisions that affect not only the frontline staff but myself. Minnesota taking this step in legislation is a first step, I believe, and there's significantly more work to be undertaken towards creating sustained civil service employment beyond the initial hiring or a 700-hour demonstration experience if we hope to retain individuals with disabilities in the state workforce. So with that said, I will just highlight some of my written testimony. What I wanted to do is share with the members some recommendations, but recommendations based on my own experiences and some of the bias and discrimination that I've experienced as an employee with disabilities. I'd ask for consideration and potentially even available if Representative Rare wanted to reach out at some point post. But the work of the advisory task force is greatly appreciated and a great starting point. The 700-hour on-the-job demonstration experience, you know, I would just ask that when we consider programs like that, that we address that they're not being created to prevent prolonged periods of probation. And I think standardization of how those procedures are done at the enterprise level is extremely important, so that programs are implemented uniformly across multiple agencies. In my particular role, I cross agencies all the time because we have to partner with multiple agencies to do our work. And my second recommendation leads directly to such an issue that has arisen in that, which is the need for an enterprise-wide plan that provisions reasonable accommodations and ensures their portability from one agency to the next. I've had difficulties using accommodations that have been arranged for me at my agency, in my work at other state agencies, even though that work was within the oversight of things that affect affect the work that I do at the Department of Public Safety. I applaud the efforts for the additional positions, especially a statewide ADA and Disability Employment Director. I would ask for consideration that a Disability Services Ombudsman be considered. Somebody that's specific role is to promote the safety and well-being and rights of the individuals with disabilities in the state's workforce and act as their advocate. I raised in my testimony a case that occurred last March where I had significant concerns about the health of my team that had been degraded far below from what I'd ever seen it before. And even in partnering with MMB's EAP organizational health team that is meant to address such things, the request for that assistance to be provided was denied, unfortunately, and even a request to intervene were laid on the table. So an ombudsman person that could look at those objectively from the employee's perspective would be helpful. And the last recommendation that I have is really about complaint resolution. You know, at the enterprise, there doesn't exist much at the enterprise level. And again, for someone that crosses from agency to agency in the work that I do, it's important that when situations arise, especially around the ability and access to accommodations, that that there is a step up on an enterprise level. And I guess what I'm suggesting is that some more work around administrative procedures and oversight at the MMB level is important to ensure that uniformity and access. Because in my case, I have a situation where the individuals that are creating barriers in the ability to perform the essential functions of my job and causing detriment to the use of my accommodations today are the same folks that are reviewing whether or not their own actions in those matters are appropriate. So it just doesn't seem to be the right lens. In closing, I just want to say, and many of you on this committee, I know from connections to my work at Driver and Vehicle Services, I take immense pride that many Minnesotans hold driver's license and IDs issued by my division, a shared experience by many. It's important that the workforce that conducts those interactions represents the diversity of Minnesota. My personal experiences with bias and discrimination in the workplace are resolvable by implementing policies such as the start of HF 2017. But I hope that retention and the language specifically around beyond the initial opportunity for sustained civil service employment for individuals with disabilities in the workforce remains a top priority and a model for other employers beyond the state of Minnesota to follow. So with that said, that concludes my testimony. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. DeVita. Representative Ryer, like I said, it's my understanding that Mr. Finley and Mr. Parker are here to answer questions and they don't need to speak. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, that's correct.
Okay. Members, any questions of the bill? Give it a couple seconds here. Any questions of the bill? Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Ryer, I see a part in this bill specifically that's very troubling. Line 1.20, we say, or the author says, in order to correct imbalances and eliminate the effects of, instead of past discrimination, you insert systemic discrimination. That appears to me to be more critical race theory by the Democrats into a bill that it shouldn't be into. I have a problem with that. Discrimination is an act, not a cultural condition, and so I'm really confused why this is in the bill. Can you explain?
Representative Ryer and Representative Druskowski, can you repeat what line you were speaking about?
1.20, Mr. Chair.
Thank
Representative Ryer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Druskowski, for your question. I'm intrigued that you equate the word systemic with racial issues in a bill that is about disability. And I would suggest that the work that the task force did found that there were structural and systemic conditions where people with disabilities were not having equal opportunities. It wasn't a one-off of a certain manager or a certain coworker. It was across and embedded in the materials that were used for training, the materials that were used for hiring and retention. So I don't see any reflection of a racial and structural, and I'm not sure where that comes from. Thank you.
Representative Druskowski.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Ryer. But we're seeing the word systemic placed in things. Discrimination is an act, it's not a condition. And so I really struggle with that. This bill is overburdened with additional growth in government in a wide variety of areas. I'll be voting no. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Druskowski. Any further questions or comments?
This is Bobby Silverstein. If I can just comment quickly.
Mr. Silverstein, yes.
Let's take an internet or the intranet or how a agency goes about having an application system. If you have a website, an online system, a mobile app, these are all systemic in nature. If they are not accessible to and usable by people with disabilities, that means certain folks will not be able to have effective and meaningful opportunity to participate. And I think that's the use of the word systemic in the context of this bill is designed to reflect those kinds of policies and procedures that deny folks effective and meaningful opportunity. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Silverstein. And testifiers, if you want to answer, if the question wasn't directed, please use the raise hand function so we can do this in an orderly fashion. Representative Quam, you had your hand up and now it's back down. Did you have a question?
Well, Mr. Chair, I was just curious as to the legislative or statute definition of systemic. Oftentimes when we put phrases into a bill and it becomes law, the courts, if there's not a specific definition, sometimes come up with, odd things and it might cause a problem. So that was my only curiosity, what the actual statute definition of systemic was.
Thank you, Representative Quam. Representative Kosnick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And if the author or staff or somebody could help me out on Section 9, it requires or asks for a description of a logical career path available for qualified individuals with disability. Can they expound on that and how would a career path, if we're trying to, how would that be laid out or what would be an example of a qualified career path for a person with disabilities in contrast to somebody without disabilities.
Representative Ryer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, Representative Koznick. I would like to defer this to the Council on Disability. I am not an expert in the career pathing world. And to me, it would imply that it aligns with the normal progression of a bill path or of a position with regard to the disability. But I would like to turn that over to the Council on Disability. That would be Mr. Turner.
Mr. Turner, if you can help with the answer to that question. And I guess I was been pointed out to me, we also didn't answer Representative Quam's question. To me, it sounded more like a statement, but about the use of the whether sustainability or systemic is defined someplace in statute. I don't know if that would be Mr. Turner or somebody else, but first, Mr. Turner, if you can answer Representative Koznick's question.
Absolutely. I would actually like to defer this to our ADA director, David Fenley. He actually chaired the task force that developed the report that this bill is based on.
Mr. Fenley, if you would identify yourself for the record, and please proceed.
Yes, Mr. Chair and committee members, David Fenley. I am the Americans with Disabilities Act director for the Minnesota Council on Disability, and I also was the chair of the task force that this legislation that essentially created this legislation. So to answer Representative Koznick's question, I think it was relating to the career path one. So we do have evidence that historically many career paths in state government have not been open to folks with disabilities for various reasons. And we put this language in here to make sure that all those options would be open and laid out by employers, specifically the state of Minnesota, make sure that those career paths are open and available to folks with disabilities.
Representative Koznick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I appreciate the answer. I guess it would seem to me that if we're trying to provide equality and opportunity in the career path should be very, very similar, and I'm not sure why there's a need to delineate a differentiation in a career path for someone with disabilities as opposed to somebody without disabilities in the bill. And so I think there's a little bit more work that needs to be done to clarify that, but I appreciate the answer and the intent of the bill, but I think there's more work to be done.
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My point being, in the past, I worked with Representative Pinto, and we both of us had done things and bills that became law on human trafficking. And we thought we did well, and a judge found some fuzzy thing in, and we had to do another bill to clarify. I think it behooves us to, when we change, verbiage, that we don't inject something that's fuzzy to the legal system and some unintended consequence pops out. That's why I asked for what the statutory definition of systemic or clarifying language in the bill, because we all see unintended consequences from the exact verbiage, and that's why it's very common to have definitions and clarifying language when we change phrases, because the interpretation by the courts is something we might not be able to guess. So that was the basis of the question. If we're going to do a bill and prove things, let's make sure that we avoid any unintended consequences. And apparently the staff that I've tried to query on have not found a definition. So that's why I was bringing up the point about us doing good legislation.
Thank you, Representative Quam. Representative Nash.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for addressing the question for Representative Quam in the text I sent you. But I think it still merits an answer, perhaps from the author of the bill. And Representative Quam's point is extremely well made, that when we pass a bill into law, and I'm not sure of the status of this in the Senate, but if this were to pass into law, this has to stand the scrutiny of the courts and all of our favorite friends, lawyers, and you can insert lawyer jokes here. But we do have to provide concise and precise language. And, you know, we've had definition debates on the floor. And I think that if we're going to go down the road of this, that the author should be able to provide a logical and defensible answer for the language articulated in her bill. And I'm kind of curious, because while I certainly recognize the need to do this, if it's left this way, I believe my side is going to be forced to be no votes, just because of the inaccuracy and a lack of preciseness in the language. So if the author would address that.
Representative Ryer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Nash, and also Mr. Quam for your questions. First, I would like to ask Mr. Gehring if there is a defined term in statute that you're aware of.
Mr. Gehring, I was going to call on you about that. Mr. Gehring, if you can help us out with the word systemic and whether it's anywhere else in statute, or whether if it's not defined in statute, what do we use as a definition for that? Mr. Gehring.
Mr. Chair, Representative Ryer, and committee members, I'm not aware of a statutory definition of that term, particularly not in Chapter 43A, which is where these changes are being made. So the way that it would be defined, I don't have a particular definition to give you at the moment. It would be defined based on case law. And but what you see here in this section is a policy statement of the state. So if someone were to challenge the implementation of that sort of policy statement, then that's where the court would be asked to provide a definition of that term.
Thank you, Mr. Gehring. Representative Greenman, what question do you have? Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just following up on, I think, the question that we're all wrapping our head around, I think there's actually lots of language in all the statute we passed that are not defined. I think the word systemic is in common use. And so, you know, just going back to my law school days, Representative Quam, what the courts will do, we'll look at a dictionary definition, and I just pulled up Merriam's Webster, and it says of or relating to an entire system, and which is, I think, what we heard Mr. Silverstein say. These are issues that relate not just to individual contact, but to the entire system, whether it's an employment system or an economic system. That is how courts traditionally look at language, all the language we pass. And so I don't actually see this as a problem. I think it's pretty common to how we press statute. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Drazkowski. Mr. Chair, we've got other bills we need to get to. So Representative
Drazkowski. Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just like to bring the committee's focus. The question is not the word systemic, but it's systemic discrimination. And that should, as Representative Quam mentioned, that should be described or defined in the bill. And I just don't see a reason for the author to insert that word systemic into language that appears to work perfectly without it. So that was my question, my suspicion, and we're seeing the Democrats continue to push this narrative of CRT and the words and language around it in bills that it doesn't belong in, and unfortunately it's burdened this one. I'll be voting no. Thank you, Mr.
Representative Nash.
Yes, thank you again, Mr. Chair. And Representative Ryer, I understand that this is something that you would like to get done, and I certainly recognize that there is a need for us to be fair in our hiring practices. And but here's the thing. You're using language that is going to, according to Representative Greenman, possibly make its way to the courts. we should work to avoid creating lawsuits and challenges in the courts in the language that we use to pass into statute. We should absolutely eschew our words when we are writing bills to only things that are actually defined in law. We heard from nonpartisan staff, and we actually heard from Representative Greenman herself. This is not a use in legal language in statute. So if the effort is to provide fairness in our hiring practices and make sure that we are accommodating the people who come to work for us, then great. Let's write a bill to do that. But let's not sprinkle in things that may be phrases that are used commonly, but have absolutely zero legal standing in the courts or in the law. And I was taught this very early on in my legislative career, that you don't put things into bills that don't have a definition in law, because it's going to be challenged immediately. And if we all are trying to just create more work for lawyer friends, then let's state that early on. But we should be very elegant in how we write bills. This is not. And I just think that this is trying to take an issue that is very heartfelt by many on both sides of the aisle, and you're trying to politicize it by using language that you might use and people on your side of the aisle might use, but that very few other people use, because as we heard, it's not in the law. So I would recommend that you amend this out and that you address it in such a way that uses a precise set of terms so that all people who are debating this or reading this or have to live underneath this, if it becomes law, are actually able to understand what it actually means. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll be voting no.
Thank you, Representative Nash. Representative Ryer, I don't see any other hands popping up. I'll give you a chance to sum up your bill quickly, because we have a couple other bills we got to get to, and go from there and maybe take the advice to heart, because this has other stops to make along the way. So, Representative Ryer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you to everyone for your feedback and comments. I am taking them all in, as that's the purpose of a hearing like this, to hear multiple perspectives and to look for ways to improve our legislation. In the case of this legislation, the words are used advisedly and with care, as listening to the experiences of task force participants and for others who they are representing, there is indeed a systemic issue, as Mr. Silverstein explained, just in the technology alone. So I'm proud to sponsor this bill. I'm proud to author this bill. I thank our testifiers for their input, and I ask for your support.
Thank you, Representative Ryer. Mr. Brinks, if you want to take the roll, I'll renew my motion that House File 2017, as amended, be referred to the Workforce and Business Development, Finance and Policy Committee. Mr. Brinks.
Thank you. Chair Nelson.
Aye.
Vice Chair Carlson.
Carlson, aye.
Representative Nash.
No.
Representative Bonner.
Aye.
Representative Drazkowski.
No.
Representative Elkins?
Aye.
Representative Greenman?
Aye.
Representative Cleborne?
Aye.
Representative Kosnick?
No.
Representative Mason?
Mason, aye.
Representative New Brindley?
No.
Representative Pawlowski?
Pawlowski, aye.
Representative Quam?
No.
With a vote of 8 ayes and 5 nays, the motion prevailed.
The motion prevails. The bill is referred to the Workforce and Business Development Committee. Thank you, Representative Ryer. The next bill we have on our agenda is House File 3136, Representative Bonner. And Representative Bonner, do you want to make the motion? This is going to the General Register.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I would like to move the bill before the committee, HF 3136, and recommend that it be sent to the General Register.
And I understand there's an amendment that came out of the Pensions Committee. Do you want to move that amendment?
We line up
with what the Senate language is.
We were not able to get that amendment prepared in sufficient time. So we do not currently have one for today.
I thought we had it in our packet here. This is the Senate amendment. We can amend it on the floor, or we could adopt the language from when it comes over from the Senate. Representative Nash, you have your hand up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Perhaps if we are waiting for the language from the Senate, we could lay this on the table and pick it up tomorrow in our regularly scheduled meeting.
Representative Nash, I'd like to get this passed along. This is similar to the presumption bill that we passed earlier. There is some people that are getting bit by this that are going to be being forced to have to pay back money, nurses that worked and inadvertently worked past December 31st. I know the Senate language is going to be coming over. Senator Kiffmeyer is going to be hearing her bill. We can just adopt the Senate language, which has this in, or we can amend it on the floor. I'd like to get this bill out of here today because there is some need to get this done quickly. Representative Nash.
Nothing further.
Thank you, Representative Nash. Representative Kosnick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. But just for procedurally, we're going to be asked to vote on a bill out of committee that isn't in the form that we already know that it will not be. I think it would probably be prudent and respectfully suggest that we do take Representative Nash's advice well taken to just wait until tomorrow, and I don't know that it'll affect the number of days that till it gets to the floor either. Probably the policy or procedures are important, and you're asking the committee to vote on something that isn't going to be in the same shape on the floor, and we already know that. I think it'd be well advised to not put the committee in that position to vote on something that's not even in the same form. Maybe we could do an informational hearing for today and then just do it procedurally tomorrow if the author knows what the change will be. That would be my suggestion. Thank you.
Well, Representative Kosnick, the amendment that was put on in the Senate, and it's written to the Senate bill, is in your packet. It's, so we know what the bill, what was done, and it's just minor tweaking and changing of a couple of dates. And like I said, the Senate's going to be hearing this and sending it over to us. There is some expediency that needs to be done to this, again, because it's affecting people, that nurses and medical staff that have worked in the system. And it's oftentimes that we pass amendments on the floor. It's not procedurally anything different from what we've done in the past. Representative Bonner, if you want to explain what this bill does, and I see there's a couple people here to answer questions if we have the bill. Representative Bonner.
Absolutely. Thank you, Mr. Chair. With that, I will go ahead and explain the bill. Members, this bill was heard on Tuesday in the Pensions Committee, and it was voted on and passed with full support of the committee members. In the beginning of the pandemic, this language originally passed in 2020 that allowed para-retirees who are healthcare workers to return to para-institutions and work more hours than previously allowed, without their pensions being penalized. We are here today to fix an unintended consequence from the 2020 language and extend this option for healthcare workers who want to come back and work more hours during this workforce shortage. In your packets, you will find that you have testimony from two amazing and dedicated nurses. At the beginning of the pandemic, Becca, who is in your packet, brought forward the idea of allowing retirees to come back to work additional hours that they were previously allowed under PARA and not lose money on their pension payments. The legislature graciously agreed, and we passed my original bill in May of 2020. But the language expired in December 31st of 2021. Another nurse in your packet, Ginny, used the same exception as Becca, but because she retired after the date of May 13th, 2020, the date the legislation was passed, she was unintentionally subjected to the limitation. And because she increased her hours, she exceeded the limit. And she is now facing losing her hard-earned money, monthly annuity payments, and paying a large sum of money back to PARA for stepping up during a difficult time to help her coworkers. Members, this bill does two really important things. For Ginny, it fixes the unintended consequences of the 2020 language that passed in the original bill, only allowing healthcare workers who retired before May 13th, 2020 to work more than the allowed hours under PARA and not lose their monthly annuity. For Becca, it extends the exception so she and all retired healthcare workers on PARA can continue to exceed the limited hours allowed under PARA until December 31st of 2025. Members, we have heard in nearly every committee in this body that the healthcare worker shortage. And there are many bills this session to address this particular issue. Healthcare workers are tired. Healthcare systems and long-term care providers have thousands of open positions, and people are retiring or leaving the field rapidly. This exception is but one tool to help the healthcare sector get through by bringing back skilled employees who want to return and contribute to caring for their patients without penalizing their hard-earned pensions. While the number of healthcare workers are small who can participate, their contributions make a huge difference to their colleagues, patients, and their employers. There is support for this bill from Long-Term Care, the Minnesota Hospital Association, and Hennepin Healthcare, because every hour a healthcare worker contribute right now matters deeply. My hope is that we can swiftly act to move this bill to the floor so that we can correct this issue for Ginny as quickly as possible and make sure Becca and other nurses, lab technicians, environmental services, and other healthcare who are under PARA, who want to work, can have more hours and can do so as soon as possible. With that, Mr. Chair, I do happen to have Susan Lincheski from the Legislative Commission on Pensions and Retirements, or LCPR, and Amy Strang from PARA, who are both here to answer potential questions on the bill.
Thank you. Any questions of the bill? If not, Representative Bonner, thank you for that. Do you need any further wrap-up? I believe you explained it well.
No, I think that pretty much covers it.
With that, Mr. Brinks, I'll take the roll. And you want to renew your motion, Representative Bonner?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I would like to move that HF 3136 be moved to the general register.
Mr. Brinks, you want to take the roll?
Thank you. Chair Nelson?
Aye.
Vice Chair Carlson?
Carlson, aye.
Representative Nash?
Aye.
Representative Bonner?
Aye.
Representative Drazkowski? Representative Elkins?
Elkins, aye.
Representative Greenman?
Aye.
Representative Cleborn?
Aye.
Representative Tosnick?
No.
Representative Mason?
Mason, aye.
Representative New Brindley?
Aye.
Representative Pawlowski?
Pawlowski, aye.
Representative Quam?
D.
Representative Drazkowski? And I apologize, Representative Quam, could you restate your vote for me?
Da.
I believe he's using a different language and saying yes.
With a vote of 10 ayes, one nay, and one abstain, the motion failed.
The motion prevails. The bill is referred to the General Register. Thank you, Representative Bonner. The last bill we have, I believe it's the last bill we have on the day, and I'm going to, because of it's my bill, I'm going to move, hand the virtual gavel over to Representative Carlson. And and Representative Carlson, I'll move House File 3091 to be referred to the General Register.
Great. Thank you, Chair Nelson. Moving House File 3091 to the General Register. Chair Nelson, if you have some opening comments on the bill.
Mr. Chair and members, this bill is a Department Administration bill. It has to do with some changes from the Department Administration, and I will let them do it forward. A couple of the big things that are in here that I know that jumped out at me as I went through it is one is it raises a trigger from 2 million to 4 million that agencies and school districts need to use when they're undertaking a project that they need to hire a designer. And with the rising costs of construction, this is part of that. Along with that, has a rate of inflation. It puts inflation in there so that we don't have to keep revisiting this every year. Every fifth year that they're going to start looking it back and seeing and looking what inflation was, and it would raise this $4 million with inflation. It's in the construction industry. And with that, members, I will let the Julie Biley from the Department of Administration explain the rest of the bill.
Yes, very good. Ms. Biley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning. For the record, my name is Julie Biley. I'm the Legislative Director at the Department of Administration. I want to thank Mr. Chair for authoring and hearing House File 3021, which is Admin's Policy and Technical Change Bill. This bill includes proposals that you may recognize from past sessions and includes provisions for a number of our divisions. I know that we are short on time, so I will try and be brief. First, we have the final two cleanup items from the move of the State Historic Preservation Office to Admin from the Historical Society in 2018. A couple of mistakes were made or missed in the language update, and this corrects those mistakes. And then as Representative Nelson alluded to, Admin provides administrative support to the State Designer Selection Board. And this is the board that selects the primary designer on building construction or remodeling projects for state agencies, the University of Minnesota, Minnesota State Colleges and Universities. And they also do that work for local building or remodeling projects that are state funded, so if they get bond dollars. For that board, we have a couple of proposals to streamline their work. First, the American Institute of Architects in Minnesota requested that we increase the threshold for the State Designer Selection Board review from $200,000 in design fees or $2 million in construction costs to $400,000 in design or $4 million in construction costs, and set a regular schedule for adjustment reviews. This threshold has not been updated since its establishment in 1996. And again, this is a recommendation of the American Institute of Architects. I will also note that any project that is below that threshold would still go through the regular state procurement process, which had for a designer and for construction. We are also clarifying which projects need review so that security upgrades and asset preservation work that meet the dollar amount are not taking up the State Designer Selection Board's time. We're also proposing to exempt consultants from state construction delays. So currently there are situations that arise when a contractor needs input from a design consultant or other professional vendor prior to proceeding with supplemental work. And if it's not within the current scope of the consultant's contract, construction work must be stopped until all of the paperwork can catch up. And this, in addition to the time it takes to investigate and develop a design solution, can add weeks to the timeline and can potentially increase the cost for a project. Currently, construction is not delayed for contractor changes, and so our bill adds design consultants to that list of exemptions from construction delays. Additionally, we'd like to add design and construction projects to the contracts that are eligible to waive the procurement process during emergencies. So we've needed this in the past, specifically during the avian flu, when we needed to build a lab for the U of M. We were not able to waive the procurement process during that, so we were not able to do it in a timely manner. And this change aligns with the national and state conversations around national preparedness. And finally, we're looking to correct our statutes to reflect the move of the Office of Collaboration and Dispute Resolution to admin in 2019. That concludes my testimony, and I will stand for any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Byrell. I see you've got a question. Members, just in terms of time management, we got about 4 minutes left here. We also have additional testifiers and three amendments. Chair Nelson, what is your preference? Do we want to get through the testimony here still today, and then we can move to member discussion and amendments at a later date? How do you wish to proceed?
Mr. Chair, why don't we get the other testifier there? The other two are there to answer questions if needed.
Okay. Representative Kosnick, I see you have your hand up. Can you maybe just make note of your question, and we'll get to that at a future date? Okay, I see you nodding your head. Great.
Mr. Chair, we have the ability to go a little bit past that they've given us this year, a little bit of leeway. Not a long time, but five or 10 minutes we can go past.
All right. Well, we'll see what we can get done. Okay. Next testifier, I have Ms. Ann Voda. Ms. Voda, can you please introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony?
Yes. Thank you, Chair and members of the committee, for the opportunity to speak in favor of HF 3091, specifically the provisions that would adjust dollar thresholds and establish a regular threshold review process for the designer selection program. My name is Ann Voda, AIA. I'm an architect and principal at Benz Thompson Richo Architects. I'm testifying today based on my own work on public projects and that use the designer selection board, and also on behalf of the American Institutes of Architects Minnesota, which also supports the legislation. This bill updates the dollar thresholds to reflect modern construction costs for building projects. This was first proposed in a 2018 report prepared by AIA, ACEC, the engineers, and the State Arts Board that examined the overall SDSB process. The current thresholds were set in 1996, so we know that those prices have changed over 25 years. This means that projects that were not originally meant to be going through the state designer selection process are now subject to it purely because these thresholds are not aligned with actual costs. I want to highlight that this will provide a simpler selection process for the state as well as architects and engineers, and allow for a greater bidding participation from a broader group of professionals on these smaller projects. Lastly, we value the work of the State Designer Selection Board to help ensure that significant public projects select designers based on qualifications as well as price. So thank you. We urge you to support House File 3091.
Thank you, Ms. Voda. Appreciate your testimony. The remaining testifiers are as needed. So let's just take these last few minutes to get to some member questions based on the testimony. Representative Kosnick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to the Ms. Bayer from admin, you mentioned the construction of a lab during the avian flu. How did the state manage around that?
Ms. Bayer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going to defer to my colleague, Wayne Wislosky. He's our Director of Real Estate and Construction Services at Admin.
Okay. I didn't catch the name, but if you could introduce yourself for the record, and please proceed with the response to the question.
Mr. Chair, members, for the record, that's Wayne Wislosky. I'm the Director for Real Estate and Construction Services at Admin. In essentially what happened was the project was delayed. As we went through the selection process for the design firm. So there was probably, if you calculate it, it was probably a 2 to 3 month delay in that project. And as we know at the time that the avian flu outbreak was having very significant economic impact in the industry. And so any delay had a financial impact.
Representative Kosnick, follow up?
No, thanks, Mr. Chair.
Okay. I'm going to keep going here until Chair Nelson cuts me. Representative Sandy Mason, I see you got your hand up. Representative Mason.
Okay, I am looking at one of the amendments where it says that nobody from the Historical Society can serve on the mediation board. But given that the State Historic Preservation Office is now in Department of Admin, does that mean somebody from SHPO can serve on the mediation board?
Mr. Chair. Sorry, Chair Nelson, you had a question or comment?
Mr. Chair, there are three amendments. None of them are mine, but Ms. Mayor barely can answer that.
So current legislation prevents the appointee from the State Historical Society from being a employee of the Historical Society. And this is a remnant of the State Historic Preservation Office being at the Historical Society, as you noted, Representative Mason. So we currently, nearly all of the appointees to this mediation task force would be from the state. So the governor has appointees, the State Historic Preservation Office has representation, but there is no representation from the Minnesota Historical Society. So we would like to give flexibility to the director of the Historical Society to make an appointment, be that an employee or someone who has the technical expertise, who is perhaps not an employee.
Mr. Chair, I think with the time we have here, I think we should probably lay this over, and I'll move we lay or just lay this over till on Monday's meeting, and we can finish up then, do the amendments, and till we give them proper time.
Perfect. Thank you, Chair Nelson. Ms. Baer, I know you had you finished your question, but I do want to give Representative Mason a chance just to follow up. Representative Mason, any was that satisfactory to a response to your question?
That's fine. Thank you.
Okay, wonderful. Members, at this point, then, we're going to lay over House File 3091, and I believe with that, we are adjourned.